906 KUOW 94.9 News and Information. I'm Bill O'Grady. The tick-borne ailment Lyme disease can be fairly benign if it's detected and treated quickly. However, if it's let go for any extended length of time, it can be quite harmful. We will hear from a woman who went undiagnosed with Lyme disease for years and is finally coming out from under it. That's starting at about 9:20. Soprano Janice Baird talks about the extreme emotional and physical conditioning necessary to sing the role of Electra at Seattle Opera. Listen for that starting at about 9:40. First of all, a woman who wrote a book about the power of oil. Here's Steve Scher.
Over 3/4 of oil is owned and controlled by world governments. How deep does it reach? Antonio Yuhas argues that oils impact many, many areas: the environment, human rights, the economy, worker safety, public health. But of that ownership and control, the biggest and most profound control is from the oil companies themselves. Antonio Yuhas is a fellow at Oil Change International and the Institute for Policy Studies. She's an award-winning writer and the author of The Bush Agenda. Her commentaries have been featured in New York Times, Democracy Now! Her new book is The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. So I guess we know where you're coming from.
A general idea, I would guess, yeah.
First of all, who's big oil? Who are the companies? What are the companies we're talking about?
So I'm looking at ExxonMobil, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, BP, Shell, and then I add Marathon and Valero in there, the largest oil companies operating within the United States. That's who I am looking at as big oil.
Okay. Are there more? Are there a few more? Well, there's all the national.
There's the state companies. There's Total.
State industries, yes.
Yeah, which would be other large companies. But these companies, not only are they the largest companies operating within the United States, but they are hands down, far and away, the most profitable corporations in the world. And the subtitle of the book, The World's Most Powerful Industry, I'm equating profit with power, because what I'm looking at and most interested in is the political influence of these companies on U.S. policies, which, of course, have dramatic impacts on all of the world and all of the world's policies, from issues from war to climate change to the economy. So that is how I come up with those companies being the most profitable industry and powerful industry in the world.
Well, let's talk about their power in terms of just what's happening with the economy right now, because you write about how what their influence is on the unregulated economy that we've seen melt down. What's happened to big oil in this economy?
Well, let's recall that the recession began not with the banking collapse, but the recession began at the beginning of the year when oil topped $100 a barrel, right? That's when our economy began a tailspin, and that's certainly when the global economy began a tailspin, that the banking crisis, you know, sent us over the edge.
Those related, by the way? The rise of oil and the banking crisis tailspin?
Intimately related, all the way down to actually one piece of legislation, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which we owe an important piece of, forevermore known as the Enron loophole, to the lobbying efforts of big oil, the nation's largest banks, and Enron, who came together in 2000 to lobby Phil Gramm, Senator Phil Gramm from Texas, the largest recipient of Enron campaign funds of any elected official, third largest recipient of oil funds of any elected official. So Phil Gramm was their target. They lobbied Phil Gramm. He snuck into the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, something called the Enron loophole, which was essentially deregulation of certain energy trades. Now, within that same bill, we had deregulation of a whole host of derivatives, which helped contribute to significantly the deregulation that led to the subprime mortgage crisis in the banks. But in terms of this loophole, what the deregulation did, and by the way, so Gramm snuck it into a bill which he then snuck into an 1,100-page omnibus appropriations bill, which was signed by Clinton in a particularly lame duck moment right after Bush had been appointed president and before Bush came into office. And this was the moment when this omnibus package was pushed through.
But Clinton did sign it.
Clinton signed it. Clinton definitely
signed it. Knowing what was there?
I imagine he knew what was there.
I've heard him say he didn't know what was there.
Then I don't know.
I've heard him say it, but I mean, you know, I don't know what the proof is. We don't have any proof of that.
Well, I mean, there wasn't any debate. There wasn't any, you know, there wasn't any committee hearings. There wasn't any floor debate. How this loophole is discussed in most of the literature is Phil Gramm snuck it into the bill in the last minute, and then it went through this omnibus appropriation. I wasn't in the room. I don't know. You know, that's the way I've seen it discussed. So what it did essentially was deregulate certain energy trades. And the very first casualty of this deregulation was the California energy crisis.
So just to be clear, so in the same way that credit default swaps were unregulated, mm-hmm. or cut loose from regulation, what was the regulatory framework and what happened with this bill?
Energy swaps were part of the swaps that were deregulated. So trades of crude oil and crude oil futures in between individual large energy actors and electricity swaps were deregulated between actors. So that means when Exxon makes a trade with Chevron or Exxon makes a trade with Morgan Stanley, we don't have to know anything about it. But that's actually not the big problem. The big problem was that the loophole allowed the energy companies to set up their very own exchanges on which to trade their energy goods. And those exchanges were completely outside of the purview of U.S. government regulators.
So U.S. government was looking at the NYMEX and things like
that. So that we do have the regulated New York Mercantile Exchange, just like the New York Stock Exchange, the place where merchants – where goods that are traditionally traded by merchants are traded. And a futures contract is simply a contract, a commitment that you and I make that I'll purchase a good from you in the future at a price set in the present. And the first thing that happened in 2000 was that Enron set up Enron Online, its very own electricity exchange. It then went to work in California, essentially what we've learned since, massively manipulating the price and availability of electricity, sending electricity out of the state, creating shortfalls, rolling blackouts. I lived through many a rolling blackout where we had, you know, no electricity for a certain period of time. Our two state public utilities went bankrupt. People's businesses shut down. The Enron folks were making out like bandits until they imploded upon their own greed.
It's had a little effect up here, too.
And it has a wee bit of effect all across the West Coast. And so Enron imploded, and we saw what they were, the manipulation they were doing. But the Enron energy traders live on, and where they live on and where they are working is for Chevron, is for BP, at Goldman Sachs, at Morgan Stanley, and at their own hedge funds, doing with crude oil precisely what they were doing with energy.
Go ahead.
On an exchange that was set up also in 2000 by Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, BP, Shell, and Total, set up their own crude oil exchange, the Intercontinental Exchange, the aptly named ICE. And on ICE is where crude oil, since 2000, has been increasingly being traded without any U.S. government regulation. And 2000 is also the moment when the price of oil began its massive ascent, but the big ascent began in 2006, and that is also precisely the same year when the number of crude oil futures trades on the unregulated ICE surpassed the number of trades on the regulated NYMEX.
Now, you're arguing a connection and a causality here, that they are through this market, they are controlling the price of oil.
Yeah, I'm arguing that speculation is the dominant at this point, not the exclusive cause of the rise and change in the price of oil, but the dominant factor, and that this is not random speculation. Some of it is. Some of it is just, you know, energy traders out to make a buck. But some of it is also energy traders who work within the oil industry, within the banking industry. And by the way, these two banks, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, may ring bells because they are the only surviving investment banks in the United States. The reason why, they have morphed into oil companies. They own oil fields. They own tankers. They own pipelines.
They weren't exposed to a lot of bad debt the way the other ones were.
They did, but they had a shelter, which was their crude and their crude futures, and the fact that they owned the exchange on which the crude futures are being traded.
Well, so are you saying that? So let's big oil is now Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, as well as Exxon and Conoco, and mm-hmm. they're, as you say, they're even owning pieces of the of the industry itself. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that they are therefore controlling and manipulating the price of oil?
All of the major oil companies in the United States have been found guilty of price manipulation on futures markets for propane, for gasoline, for oil. And that's these are in the last 2 years.
Okay.
So this is on the regulated NYMEX. So this is the U.S. Commodity Futures the regulatory body that regulates the NYMEX has found the major companies guilty of price manipulation on its regulated exchange.
How do they
have
no
idea what's happening on the unregulated exchange.
How do they do that manipulation?
It's different tools in terms of trying to corner markets. So trying to BP, for example, found guilty of trying to corner the propane market in the United States, trying to buy up so many futures in propane that they can control, shift the price up. Illegal trades. It's trades that are unsound, too large. There are limits on how big trades can be, the nature and relationship between trades, the relationships between traders. And essentially, what happens on the unregulated ICE is that we have no idea who's behind the trades, the relationships of the trades, the ultimate size of the trades.
You know, we saw this unregulated market collapse because of their own greed. In the financial sector, is it possible that we'll see the same collapse on this sector?
Well, here's what's so unfortunate about trading a commodity upon which the entire global economy is based on an unregulated exchange. We have definitely seen a speculative bubble in oil. However, it's based on the reality that this is a product that even though we're not there now, we will at some point be at a point where demand exceeds supply. So it's a speculative bubble built on a reality of a product that will reach an end. And so what that means is that, first of all, no one can tell you where the price is going to go on any given day. What we're experiencing right now is a massive tumble, but also massive price volatility. So it was only 2 weeks ago that we had the highest one-day run-up in the price of crude in the history of crude being traded. It increased by $25 in 1 day. Then we had 3 days later the biggest drop in 2 years. Now we've had a little bit of an up, and now we're back down below $70 a barrel. This is volatility inherent in a sort of world market gone mad. I mean, we don't know exactly what's going on anywhere right now. Also, there's the prediction that demand is definitely going to fall. If we are about to have a major global recession, demand for oil is going to fall. It is also, though, the individual actors of individual traders trying to figure out what they want to do for their own profit at the end of the day, and we don't know what they are doing.
All right. Well, let's come back to the question of markets. Antonio Juhas has written The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry, and What We Must Do to Stop It. You can find links to her work and some other interviews as well at kuow.org.
A wide range of guests on wide-ranging topics, weekday mornings from 9 to 11. The previous segment is available at our archives at kuow.org. You can search on the keyword oil. The hazards of Lyme disease, especially when it goes undiagnosed for any length of time. In a moment, 919 KUOW 949 News and Information. I'm Bill O'Grady. The head of the Doctors Without Borders mission in Haiti talks about chaos and desperation still reigning there 6 weeks after Hurricane Ike. Listen for that in the 11 o'clock hour tonight. Forecast for tonight, lows around 40, partly cloudy, some areas of fog after midnight. Wednesday, highs around 60, sunny skies after areas of morning fog. Sports writer Dave Zirin argues that sports and politics are inseparable. He says players aren't even free to express political views. Zirin talks about his new book, A People's History of Sports in the United States. Tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Support for KUOW comes from Clear Path International, marking 8 years of helping victims of landmine accidents in Southeast Asia with Moon on the Mekong, a benefit event on Bainbridge Island, November 8th. More information at cpi.org. Clear Path International, when wars end, landmines remain.
KUOW and Richard Hugo House present Road Trip, featuring new work by Amy Bender, Matt Ruff, and Marie Howe, with music by Lori Catherine Carlson. October 24th at Richard Hugo House. For more information, visit our community page at KUOW.org.
Training for extreme opera, Richard Strauss's Elektra at Seattle Opera in about 20 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Megan Sukes. A tick bite that leaves behind a red bullseye-shaped rash is a symptom of Lyme disease. Lyme disease is the most common tick-borne disease in our area of the world, and it can be treated effectively with antibiotics if it's diagnosed early. If it's not treated right away, infections can affect the joints, the heart, even the nervous system. Anna Hart lives south of Gig Harbor in a little town called Home. It took her 5 years to get diagnosed with Lyme disease. And during that time, she suffered from months of extreme nausea, neurological complications, and even had to use a wheelchair. Anna, when do you think you contracted Lyme disease?
I was on a camping and canoeing trip in 1998 after I had finished my last year of high school and the first year of college in the same year. So I thought, hey, I'm pretty good. I can take a little trip. So I went and I had the most beautiful spiritual experience on a canoe trip with a Lakota elder man. It was a beautiful trip that opened up my eyes to a lot. We were trying to raise awareness about the Wabash River, which is where we were canoeing down, because it was on the 10 most polluted rivers list of the whole country. So we're trying to get towns to be a little more aware of what they put into their river and to make them a little more aware of the native culture that is around them. And I had this beautiful transcendental journey and ended up after that 2.5 canoeing trip, which was the hard camping, no showers, anything like that. I noticed on my host's front deck that something was feeling weird on my inner left thigh. So I went into the bathroom to check it out, and there was a very large red rash growing on the inner left thigh. And now here I have to say that I was rather unique to get the bullseye rash, because it was found that only up to 50% of people ever see that rash, because sometimes it can be in places where you don't see very well behind your ears, for example. And some people just don't get the rash at all. So I had this big spreading rash that actually went to behind my knee. Well, I asked everybody about it that I could show to, and they said, don't worry, things around here bite, give you all kinds of rashes. Go home, don't worry about it. And then by the next year, 1999, I started a job at the local Thriftway Bakery, and I just started to be nauseous every day, and it continued for 8 months that year. And for 6 of those months, I was vomiting every single day, unable to keep even water down. But the doctors did all kinds of gastrointestinal tests, and they went down from up top, they went up from up bottom, and found nothing. Told me, my stomach is fine, you must have some heartburn, and sent me home with the purple pill. And it was just years after that of falling further and further behind of what my normal health should have been.
When did you realize or get the term Lyme disease to connect with the symptoms you were suffering from?
Well, like many people, I went online after having my local doctor tell me that we don't know what's wrong with you, the labs show nothing. So I looked up my symptoms, and I found this one page that described the 3 stages of Lyme. And the first stage is very simple. You kind of feel like you have a flu, and I did when I was at the camping trip. And you just get tired and achy. But by 1999, I was in the second stage of Lyme disease, which means that now the bacteria is disseminating through the body and causing multi-systemic problems, which is the reason that my stomach was so involved at first. But it stretched when it got to my brain was the part when it was really scary. Having seizures, having these points where I would black out and not remember a few days afterwards was really scary.
Anna Hart lives in Home, Washington. It's just south of Gig Harbor. 10 years ago, she was bitten by a tick that developed into Lyme disease. But it took, Anna, it took you 8 years to get an effective diagnosis. When did you get Now, with Lyme disease, it can be treated with antibiotics if caught early. Did you get any early antibiotics for Lyme disease?
Well, after we being my mother and I, brought our printed up page of all of the different symptoms of the different stages and pointed out that I had mirrored classically up to the second stage, we said, would it hurt me to have a round of antibiotics? And Dr. Rose went, nope, did off the prescription and said, go home. And so I finally was feeling a little bit better, and for the first time in 8 months, to wake up not nauseous was a beautiful gift. And I thought, maybe this is the end of this horrible year I've been having. But it was only the start.
It had been just about a year since you had gotten this tick bite. You'd been able to match your symptoms to Lyme disease, finally gotten a round of antibiotics. This sounds like this should be the end of the story, Anna. You got the antibiotics, you should have been better. What happened?
Well, some things got better, and other things either started to creep up after the antibiotics or just never went away, like fatigue. I could not have the strength to go out for a walk up and down my block, and I couldn't even have the strength to walk out into my yard to go to my own dock, which I lived on Crescent Lake at the time. I started experiencing this brain fog, which people with Lyme, we call it Lyme fog. And it's like your brain is wading through these murky waters trying to figure out what to say, what is the right response to the question that's just been asked of me. And I couldn't get it. I was a good student, and in advanced classes, and suddenly I sometimes couldn't remember where I was or what I was doing. I would walk over to the kitchen and forget completely that I had got there for a glass of water. And I would just stand there looking around, just completely unsure, in my own home. So we went back to the doctor and said, didn't work. So he said, well, then it's not Lyme. And so I went through many diagnostics tests from many doctors all around the Tacoma area. My doctors were consulting with the UW doctors, and it really wasn't until I started presenting with seizures and localized paralyzation that I was taken seriously.
This is a very extreme reaction to go from flu-like symptoms to being in a wheelchair. What was going on in your mind that it took getting into a wheelchair to be taken seriously?
The wheelchair didn't really get me any sympathy, shall we say, from my normal doctors. I was actually told, get up and walk when I couldn't. I was showing all of these neurological defects in the actual doctor's office, and they were still telling me, looking down at their test papers, that nothing is wrong and I can go home. It's maddening. You actually do have at least a few times where you start to wonder yourself, am I crazy? Is my body making this stuff up? But when I got to meet other people with Lyme, and they said, oh yeah, your story, just like mine. I finally got, the strength to face down doctors.
How did you face down a doctor finally to get a diagnosis that put you on a path to treatment?
I had to search one out. I had to search one better than someone from the infectious disease specialty, because their soundbite is that Lyme is hard to get and easy to treat. It took actually my own research and finding a doctor that knew about Lyme in British Columbia, Canada, where I could make an appointment with him. And this is a lovely man who, I called him on a Wednesday, and he had me up in his office that Saturday on his day off, and he gave me 2.5 hours of his time where he let me talk about what happened through those 3 years. It was a definitive clinical diagnosis of Lyme disease and possible co-infections by the end of that visit.
How long was that from when you had gotten the bite from the tick in Indiana?
That was 3 years. So it was 3 years of not knowing where I was going, not knowing where my body would, or when my body would betray me. It was 3 horrible years of uncertainty, and coming out of the BC physician's office was like a breath of fresh air. Somebody who wasn't telling me that I was faking my symptoms for attention. Someone who wasn't telling me that it was all in my head.
Anna Hart lives in Home, Washington, just south of Gig Harbor. It took her 8 years from a tick bite she got on a rafting trip in Indiana to get a diagnosis, a complete diagnosis of Lyme disease and treatment. We're just 3 years after the tick bite, Anna, so I want you very much to be feeling a lot better by this point in the story, but we still have evidently 5 more years to go. What happened?
So after I had a clinical diagnosis, it didn't really mean anything back in the States, because a Canadian doctor can't prescribe for me unless I'm willing to go to Canada and pick up all those prescriptions at my own cost, and I didn't have insurance at the time.
Anna, if Lyme disease has infections related to it, I don't understand why there wasn't just a blood test that you could see you had an infection.
Well, I had many blood tests done for Lyme. The woeful part of this is that Lyme is a very sneaky bugger. The bacteria itself, called a spirochete, can morph into different, call them stages. These bacteria, they have been known to actually mate, and I say that with quotes, because they have been able to exchange genetic information with each other and actually morph inside the body. So what the antibiotics were going for before will completely miss the next time around because they're different.
Anna, you're describing the bacteria that are part of Lyme disease and why it was so hard for you to get a diagnosis. When did you finally get a diagnosis that put you on the path to getting better?
Finally, 5 years after the tick bite, I sent my blood down to a specific lab called Igenix down in California. And this is a lab that for the past about 20 years now has been focusing solely on tick-borne infections. And finally, I had a full positive test.
What was your reaction when you got, 8 years later, you'd been in a wheelchair, you'd suffered seizures. What was your reaction when you finally got a positive diagnosis for Lyme disease?
I sat down on my coffee table and cried from joy. And that's really weird to say for getting I'm positive for a disease. But after all those years of I intrinsically did know what was happening, and I believe in myself. To finally have the doctor in Canada, he called me up and just said, "You're positive." And I just sat down and cried wherever I could. Recently, there was a movie called Under Our Skin released, and it is a Lyme documentary following a few patients and hearing from both sides of the story, one side being the infectious disease doctors who say it's hard to get and easy to treat, the other side, the ILADS doctors, the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, they believe it's easy to get and it's very hard to treat when it's in the later stages. It is, everybody says there is a cure available if you catch this early. However, if it goes on forever and gets misdiagnosed as lots of other things, like so many people experience, as I did, you just find yourself worse. And so recently, because I've been able to get out of my wheelchair, my doctors asked me to join them at a screening at Bastyr University in Kenmore for Under Our Skin. And I was asked to join the panel so that people in the audience could ask questions. And I was the only patient panelist there. And so together we are trying to raise awareness in our state so that nobody has to go through what I had to go through. It was emotionally, physically, and spiritually a tough road. And that's putting it very lightly.
Finally, Anna, I find myself thinking back to the canoe trip where this all started. The tick bite started the Lyme disease, but before that you said you had a transcendental experience canoeing with this Lakota Indian and what you were able to do. Looking way back to that experience, was there anything on that trip that you think might have given you the strength that you needed to take on this fight?
There was one night when it was about halfway through the camping canoeing trip, that one night we set up in a camp and there were only about five of us, and we just started talking about different experiences that we've had. That night we had pipe ceremony with the holy man who was accompanying us, and I remember he handed me the pipe himself. And there was something about that pipe, there was something about the energy that I felt in that I do often go back to and take strength from that moment, because it was one of the best nights of the trip.
That makes me feel better, Anna, because I think about that canoe trip being the start of such a difficult journey. And so thank you for sharing that story, that even as I think about what you had to go through, that perhaps, though that trip was the start of the Lyme disease, it may also have been the start of what gave you the strength to do this fight. And at this point, at this happy ending of getting treatment, being able to reach out to others and share your experience.
Absolutely. It's wonderful being able to put more than three sentences together. You know, if we had tried this interview even 3 years ago, I couldn't. So for the gift that I have for life today, I'm very, very thankful. Yeah, the universe, it works out all in its own time.
Thank you so much, Anna. Anna Hart lives in Home, Washington, just south of Gig Harbor, and for the past 10 years, she's been battling Lyme disease. Also took part with a documentary called Under Our Skin about Lyme disease. And if you'd like more information on Lyme disease in this documentary, go to kuow.org and search for TICK. From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Megan Sukes.
Interviews with all kinds of folks with ties to the Pacific Northwest, weekday afternoons at 2 o'clock. The preceding interview is available at our archives at kuow.org. You can search on the keyword diagnosis. The woman singing Electra at Seattle Opera talks about the high intensity of the experience in a moment. 940, KUOW 94.9 News and Information. I'm Bill O'Grady. When it comes to airline internet access, the sky really is the limit. As carriers add Wi-Fi capabilities, some are also adding filters to the content. Technology reporter Glenn Fleischman checks in on the flight path of airline internet access. He also uncovers the pros and cons of digital rights management and tries to draw the line between work and working vacation. It's all tomorrow afternoon at 2. Weather forecast for the Seattle-Tacoma-Everett area for tonight, lows around 40, partly cloudy, some areas of fog after midnight. Wednesday highs around 60, sunny skies, some areas of fog in the morning. Support for KUOW comes from area schools affiliated with the Pacific Northwest Association of Independent Schools. More information about open houses, financial aid, and the range of education choices, such as Billings Middle School, are online at pnais.org. Keith Sarabica reads Going, Going, Gone by Peter Blauner, and Christina Pickles reads The Purple is Everything by Dorothy Salisbury Davis, right after the 10 o'clock news.
It's incredible. It's just like an arrow being let go from a bow and taking off, and you can't stop it.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Dave Beck. An obsession for revenge lies at the heart of the 1909 Richard Strauss opera Elektra. Generations of family dysfunction, murder, betrayal, and ritual sacrifice have taken their toll on Elektra. This character, familiar from ancient Greek mythology, exists in a maniacal state as her story unfolds in the Strauss opera. Elektra seeks to avenge her father, murdered at the hands of Elektra's mother and her mother's lover. The one-act opera by Strauss is remarkable for its musical innovations, dramatic and vocal demands, and its unyielding intensity. Janice Baird is the American soprano, making her Seattle opera debut as Elektra on stage at McCall Hall from October 18th through November 1st. Known for many Strauss and Wagner roles, she has sung at the Metropolitan Opera in New York and across Europe. Janice Baird will be a familiar presence at Seattle Opera in coming months when she returns to sing the role of Brunhilde in Wagner's Ring Cycle this coming summer. She's with us in our studios, and it's great to meet you.
Hi, nice to meet you too, Dave.
What sets Elektra apart from other roles that you sing?
Well, yeah, Elektra is, as you mentioned, one of the most intense and maniacal characters. Unstoppable energy, an opera that is, as we were quoting before, one unending crescendo.
Yeah.
It's an amazing amount of energy and highs and lows. She goes through all the spectrum of a woman's emotion, hatred, lusting for revenge, loving loss, the loss of her father, the loss of her brother, finding her brother, all the tenderness and the love for that, for her younger brother, and the revenge, and she succeeds in having her parents, her mother and her stepfather, murdered, and I think is empty through the experience.
Yeah.
I think it's an experience. It's such a cathartic experience. There's nothing more for her. She goes through the ultimate in those 90 minutes or how long is the opera actually?
I don't know if I remember seeing it a few years ago at Seattle Opera, and it kind of suspends time. I mean, once it's launched, it's just this kind of fury is unleashed.
It's incredible. It's just like an arrow being let go from a bow and taking off, and you can't stop it. It's the unfurls from the moment it starts. It's a shock. When it's over, I think you should just be exhausted in your seat. You
know? What just hit me?
Yeah, exactly.
I remember feeling that as an audience member, but I wonder what kind of a performance experience that is.
It's very intense. It's very intense.
Yeah.
It's very gratifying. It gives you a great amount of energy because it's... Because, as I say, you go through everything. You go through the highs and lows, and the most intense female character, one of the most intense female characters ever written. So, as a woman singing it, you're experiencing all these emotions, and on top of that, singing this incredibly difficult score, difficult dramatically, vocally, terrifying, with beautiful music too. It's an enormous challenge,
mm-hmm.
yeah. and mm-hmm. and it's gratifying too. And when you've done it well, and it's a of course gives you great energy. It's also exhausting.
Yeah. Well, you talk about these different emotions that they're so much wrapped up in this character. How do you kind of tease that out, or how do you even begin to sort of
to
explain what Elektra's all about? Because that she does. She just comes to the stage with this incredible backstory of all these horrible things that have happened in the family, and so we meet her in kind of a. She's kind of a mess, I guess.
She's had a rough life, poor dear, and she's obsessed about the death of her father and how he was murdered, and that I think that vision, that image of his death tortures her, and she's can't understand how anybody else can continue to function as if nothing happened. She is a heroine in that sense that she never can let go of that mission. She goes through so many highs and lows. The moment where she is told that her brother Orest is dead, and that she has to decides that she has to take on the killing herself, and really lives the loss of her brother and the loss of that young boy who she loved, and that it's all a woman who has an enormous imagination and lives in her imagination, and then. Goes through this, it's an emotional roller coaster where she goes through losing, thinking she's lost her brother, finding him again, finding that he is indeed alive, and everything that she's wished for all these years in waiting alone, as she continually talks about herself being alone, and he finally comes, her brother, and all of that, all of those horrible wishes are fulfilled, and I think, and then there's nothing left for her.
And when he finally arrives, she's so confused. She doesn't recognize him.
Of course, she hasn't seen him since he's 3 years old or 4 years old.
Yeah.
He's taken away as a small child, and she's only heard stories about him. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's not revealing that it's even him because of
who this crazy woman is. She's this filthy creature out on the steps of the court, mad.
Right.
And he comes in and doesn't know anyone. Doesn't because it's been 15 years. They don't recognize each other, and she thinks she's one of the maids cleaning the taking care of the rooms. Yeah,
right. You've done this a number of times now. Mm-hmm. How do you even begin to sort of get into a character like that? I mean, the stories are so complex and rich, but to encapsulate all that and to kind of bring this to the stage.
First of all, you've got the best story possible. I mean, it's brilliantly written. I speak German. My husband's German, so I speak fluent German. The poetry is incredibly beautiful, and the psychology of the Hoffmannsthal character is so strong, and it works so well that it's all there for you if you just read the music and do what they're telling you to do. And you're speaking the words and singing the music, and the music is telling you the emotion also, the lyricism of the moment or the brutality of the moment. Elektra changes, and she's completely mercurial and changes her moods from one moment to the next, very, very strong, and that's very strong in the music, and very clear in the music. I relate to her. I feel for her. I'm sorry for her loss, and I admire her sticking, that she stands through it all and doesn't give up. Everybody's telling her, Elektra, give up, get a life, go on, move on, you know, and she can't let go. And it touches me. I'm very personal. I don't know why.
How do you feel about her when she's trying to bring her sister into this? You know,
I mean, she's quite crazy, of course.
And sister doesn't want to have much to do with this.
I can understand not wanting to have anything to do with killing your parent and your step parent.
Yeah,
I mean,
don't want to go there.
I don't want to go there. Yeah. I admired Elektra, but I mean, of course, it's. I don't want to be her. It's very. I'm saying to Spate also that Spate Jenkins, the general director of the opera,
yeah.
That it's a very catharsis to sing this role because you get to act out everything negative that you could possibly want. You don't have. There's not much left over of negativity once you've done Elektra, of course. But she also has a very warm side and a vulnerable side that touches me. In the middle of all this strength, where you think, oh, she's just a monument, she's fragile and very breakable and vulnerable. And that fascinates me. That's the shades of character, all the different.
Yeah.
The thing that appealed to me about singing Elektra was that this vulnerability that I see in her. So I think I've always, that has always been there for me. What the first thing, of course, that hits you when you just briefly hear it is this enormously dramatic music, but it grows also for me. I get to know her more, and I every time I do a new production with a different director, I get different views of the characters, and I've grown to appreciate all the characters. I've grown to have much more sympathy for Clytemnestra, for her mother, and as I've done the role.
How so there? Because
oh, she's pretty horrible.
Yeah, she's
all very
she's
highly
she's,
dysfunctional she's, family.
Yes, that,
to put she's, it mildly.
She's murdered her husband, yeah.
But her, you know, the pre-story to Elektra, of course, is that Agamemnon was away at the Trojan Wars and had. Been unfaithful to her and had her not in reality didn't turn out to be the truth, but as far as Clytemnestra knows, he sacrificed her oldest daughter in order to have the winds change for their fleet to be able to attack.
Yeah,
so
Iphigenia,
yes, exactly, yeah. Which has also been played here. So the Clytemnestra, of course, has a lot of reason. I would not love the man who was not only sleeping with another woman, in love with another woman, but also killed our first child.
Yeah.
You know I mean, so there's a lot of bitterness between them.
this dysfunction has
yeah.
deep root.
Well, it's
which is a fascinating
yeah,
idea.
It's this kind of curse. Yes, it's fascinating. Yeah, yeah, that's yeah. it. These people that are just cursed. You know, this the fate, this heavy fate on all of them. You know, and they're also. I feel, and they're close, Clytemnestra and Elektra too. I think that the women are mother and daughter. It's they understand each other, and in their hatred, they also, you know, and through all of this, Clytemnestra lost everything. She lost Elektra also. She lost her other daughter, and she didn't win anything.
Yeah. Janice Baird is our guest, the American soprano, making her Seattle Opera debut this fall as Elektra in the Richard Strauss opera of the same name, continuing on stage at McCall Hall through November 1st. How does doing a role like this cause you to ponder the nature of revenge that just lies
oh,
at the...
Oh, well, it's so human, of course, yeah. I mean, it's you, awful thing, isn't it? Yeah, and of course, and it traps her, and it ruins her life. And I mean, that is the lesson to learn, that wanting revenge for something and not letting go of something is the wrong thing for yourself. She destroys herself because of it. Yeah. Of course, it actually is a lot of fun to play somebody that's doing that because I can't do that in real life. But it is therapeutic in its own way.
It's therapeutic.
It is therapeutic, of course, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about it being, you know, cathartic, but... Yeah, yeah. Tell me about that.
It's stuff that you're not allowed to do. I mean, it's absolute taboos, you know. I mean, uh-huh. You know, we're talking about, you know, you're not allowed to feel these things. I mean, you shouldn't, not if you're a good person, doesn't, you know, and you certainly don't act on them. As I say, I also think the lesson in Elektra is that acting on this didn't give this character anything, and the curse continues, and this woman's life is ruined for it. And she is, it is, even though I find it admirable and tragic and grand, as an opera and as a piece of art, it is also, of course, a lesson in that forgiving and moving on is the right choice for a healthy life. But it's still that's why we have art.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We get to examine these things freely too. Yeah.
What are the moments in your association with this character? Times in performance, times of study, just times of immersing yourself in her world, that stand out for you now as you've done it a few times and are preparing for another big production.
I mean, I can tell you stories of I have the wildest accidents usually, and knock wood, shall not have them this one, but I've run out on stage on Elektra and gone flying, done somersaults on stage, and I. And I have had some wild accidents because being carried away with what I'm doing, usually in rehearsals.
Where was this?
The very first time I sang this role, I went out for the first time on stage in rehearsal with the stage set and the original lighting, and hadn't walked the stage. Which you usually do if you're a smart opera singer. You walk the stage first. You don't do what I did. I never done it before, and I won't do it again. And there were broken pieces of iron building parts that had broken down, that were part of the scene that nobody had told me about in rehearsal. Yeah. And I went out, and my first entrance was to run out on stage and spit at the maids, which is kind of normal production, you know. So I ran out, and I flew over this piece of building material that was on the stage, did a 360 flip, and landed on the other side of the stage in front of the director of the opera company on my back and looked up see his white face. And I got up in my Elektra hysteria and ran on and continued and did the whole rehearsal. But
this wasn't full of the audience. I mean, but
no, this was a rehearsal. This was,
but you kept going.
I kept going.
Oh, well, yeah, that's a little jolt of adrenaline appropriate for...
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah, the thing with the Elektra is the adrenaline. It gives you a lot... You're running on hormones, you know, and adrenaline. It's quite a drug itself.
Yeah. Well, I thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about Elektra.
Thank you for having me here.
And I hope you get to take a deep breath before when this is over and preparation for Brunhilde and the 2009 Ring commences. We'll look forward to talking to you then.
Thanks a lot.
Our guest has been Janice Baird, the American soprano. She makes her Seattle Opera debut this fall as Elektra in the Richard Strauss opera of the same name. Information about the production is at our website, kuow.org, or you can go to seattleopera.org. Janice speaking with us about the dramatic, musical, and vocal demands of the Strauss one-act opera created in 1909. Monday, October 13th, 2008, KUOW 94.9. I'm Dave Beck.
Interviews with all kinds of folks.